enough the Republicans to wake up is... The Republican Party right now is not led by conservatives. There's a population out there that has to be told the truth. We have to. Do it live!
Now, from the left coast, it's another podcast edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Peter B. is curious, opinionated, and relentless in pursuit of the truth like a honeybee drawn to pollen. He's an independent progressive, ready to sting Republicans and Democrats alike when they deserve it. After years in commercial radio, Peter B. welcomes you to this audio adventure in news and politics with no corporate filter. Listeners support this program, and you can help at peterbcollins.com. Here's your humble host, Peter B.
Hey, thanks for downloading the latest episode of the Peter B. Collins Show, supported by great listeners, including Stuart J. Smith, Gail, you know who you are, Gail with a Y, Raymond Welch, and Mark Dennis. They voluntarily subscribe to this program, and you can do it too. That is, if you're financially able and so inclined. Just go to my website, peterbcollins.com. The links are on the right-hand side of the homepage, and our voluntary subscriptions start at just $5 a month. Right before the end of this podcast, Gary Chu, the official film reviewer of the Peter B. Collins Show, checks in to talk about the new Clint Eastwood produced and directed film starring Leonardo DiCaprio about J. Edgar Hoover. It's called J. Edgar. And he was a nemesis in the early portion of my life as a broadcaster. I even filed a Freedom of Information Act request to find out if I was one of the people being monitored under COINTELPRO. But let's talk about more contemporary games of criminal justice, counterintelligence, false flags, and similar matters. Gareth Porter is the historian and journalist who's been on our program many times before. He returns today with a lot of appreciation from me for continuing to pursue the story that broke on October 11th when President Obama alleged that we had broken up a plot by Iranians to assassinate the Saudi ambassador to Washington, D.C. Gareth, good to talk to you again. How are you today?
I'm good. Thanks for having me again, Peter.
And you've been digging into this story. I have yet to find a credible observer who believes this whole episode and the outlandish allegations that have not only been put forward by the United States, but are now as taken as fact and being used to advance some very interesting policy shifts.
Well, that's exactly right. I mean, it's obviously an event that has been created with a political agenda behind it. And I must say at the outset, and I know this is something we will talk about a little bit more during your program, that this is not a one-off situation. This is part of a broader pattern historically in which so-called terror plots allegedly undertaken by Iran have been put forward by the United States and some of its other allies as a way of maneuvering to isolate and weaken Iran and make it more vulnerable to various schemes. This is a pattern that goes back to the early 1990s, and I would mention specifically the 1994 bombing of Buenos Aires, a Jewish community center, and the 1996 Khobar Towers bombing as cases which resemble this in some ways, in that the charge that Iran was behind these bombing plots in both those cases, bombs that did go off, was outlandish. There was basically no evidence to support that, but the United States went whole hog in both cases to try to make a case that Iran was behind them. Now we have a case where not only did no bomb go off, but there was no plot. There was was clear from the FBI report on this so-called terror plot that the idea of assassinating the Saudi ambassador in Washington, D.C. came from the U.S. side. There's absolutely no evidence in this record, no quote from Arbabsiar, the Iranian-American who was caught up in this, that he had expressed any interest in this until the DEA informant that he believed that he was dealing with the Las Zetas drug cartel man. In fact, there's reports that he is a Las Zetas drug cartel man, but he's bought off by the DEA as an informant. And that the DEA informant put the idea forward and kept pushing until he got a favorable response from Arbabsiar. Now, this raises the question of what was really going on. What was this really all about? And in my articles, I put forward two possibilities. The first is that this was, in fact, a contact made by Arbabsiar on behalf of a group in Iran that had control of a lot of opium from Afghanistan, and that he was hoping to make a deal with the Las Zetas cartel to sell them a great deal, tons of opium, as was reported by both the New York Times and by Bloomberg in their coverage based on a source within the Justice Department or the FBI. And that what went on was that, again, the FBI stepped in, turned this into a sting, and raised the possibility that they could make a deal based on, using the drug cartel to do some dirty business for this group, which he apparently on the basis that he had told them that he had a cousin who was in the Quds Force,
right,
and that was the connection that was made. Now, the second possibility, which I happen to think is more likely, because it seems to fit the evidence more closely, is that Arbabsiar was, in fact, given a mission by the people that he knew in Tehran who were in the Quds Force to engage this somebody in the drug cartel world of Mexico to carry out a program of surveillance of targets, including Saudi and Israeli targets in the United States and perhaps elsewhere, particularly in Mexico, to prepare the ground for potential retaliation in case Iran were to be attacked by Israel, of course, with what the Iranians would believe was the complicity of Saudi Arabia. Now, the point that I would make and that I've made in my coverage of this is that it's somewhat credible for the following reasons. First of all, the Iranians did something similar in 1994-95 in Saudi Arabia. They had their friends in Saudi Arabia carry out surveillance, and the Iranians themselves were involved in this, carry out surveillance of U.S. military and diplomatic targets in Saudi Arabia. They did so in a way that clearly was not intended to be kept covert, because the Americans knew about it. They were following it all along. They knew it was happening.
Mm-hmm.
They talked about it openly. The Americans told the Iranians that they knew about it. And so this was clearly a deterrence operation. They were telling the Americans, we have options in case you or the Israelis attack us. We can retaliate against your facilities in Saudi Arabia. It was another piece that they could add to their menu of options for retaliation as a matter of deterrence. The second point, which is, I think, an important one to understand about this, is that Arbabsiar, who was known as a kind of bumbling used car salesman in Texas,
can't even find his cell phone.
Can't find his cell phone. it is credible to me that he could have been used for this purpose because the Iranians did not expect or even want this to remain covert. They expected the Americans to know about it. They knew that the Americans had penetrated the Las Zetas cartel and other drug cartels in Mexico, in many cases at high levels, and that anything that took place would quickly get back to the Americans. And so that would be, again, the purpose would be to let the Americans know that they could carry out surveillance on targets. targets in Washington, D.C., as well as elsewhere, and that this would be another, and of course the Israelis and the Saudis would also be the subject of this deterrence scheme.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, that is what fits the evidence that we have from the FBI account of this. Not a terrorist plot scheme, of course. The Iranians are not so stupid as to do that. That would be an invitation by the United States or to the United States and Israel to get together and to attack Iran. But a deterrence scheme, of course, is not something the United States government or Israel wants to talk about, because that raises the problem for them that the Iranians could have a legitimate reason for having options for retaliation.
Mm-hmm. Well, Gareth, in any event, what you've described there, these possible scenarios, what they do fit neatly with is the reference I made to J. Edgar Hoover and COINTELPRO, because what he did domestically was get black nationalist groups to fight among themselves, and he infiltrated the Black Panthers and other groups with paid FBI informants. They were always people who were already on the wrong side of the law, either on probation or they plea bargained out of a prosecution by becoming a government agent. And that model is tried and true and is back in action today. And so it was Joe Lauria who wrote a piece pointing out that there have been 17 different domestic prosecutions for alleged terrorism that all involve a paid FBI informant, and in virtually every case, that is someone who is compromised by their own illegal behavior that makes them an easy puppet.
Right.
For the government to get them to do things like suggest provocative actions to people who hadn't even been considering them. And whether it's the case in Oregon, the Lodi Mosque case here in California, the Miami Six, I think they're called, the pattern is very clear. And whether we ultimately learn what our Bob Sear was up to or not, we can see that this is an infiltrated situation, and we cannot possibly take at face value what our government is telling us. This is a concocted scheme.
That's totally right. Exactly what I believe happened, and have written, in fact, in one of the pieces that I've done on this, which is a longer analysis of the FBI account. And the holes and contradictions in that, I point out precisely what you talked about, the set of FBI sting operations, terrorist sting operations, in which they clearly, deliberately provoked individuals who had no intention of getting involved in any terrorist scheme whatsoever to do something that they could use to suggest that they were somehow involved in a terrorist operation. And I quote one instance where it was clear that one of the people who was indicted for terrorism had no idea what was going on. I mean, it was completely underhanded. And so it's not difficult at all to believe that the FBI was involved in trying to, and succeeding in this case, in getting Arbab Sear to say something after a number of efforts in which they failed to do so, which would compromise himself and suggest that he was open to an assassination plot against the Saudi ambassador. But there's absolutely no reason to think that he was speaking there on behalf of the Iranian government, that there was something that had been approved by anybody whatsoever. And I think it's distinctly possible. I mean, we know for one thing that Arbab Sear was brought into the sting operation at some point before he was arrested. I mean, it's very clear that when the FBI instructed their DEA informant to tell Arbab Sear that he had to either provide half the money that was supposedly going to be given to the Las Vegas cartel up front, or to personally serve as the insurance policy that the money would be paid by physically going to Mexico City and being obviously a sitting duck in case anything went wrong. Now, this is not something that even an Arbabsiar who couldn't find his cell phone would be stupid enough to agree to. But we have the record showing that Arbabsiar immediately agreed gleefully, you know, with alacrity, to go to Mexico City, not even having consulted with his confederates beforehand. Now, that tells us that he was already part of the scheme. He knew that there was never going to be any situation where he was putting himself in danger by being in the hands of the Las Zetas cartel.
Let me clarify that. So Arbabsiar believed that he was essentially being embraced by the FBI and that he had a kind of immunity or impunity of his actions because he felt he was in on the game.
He had already been told that he would get off light, that he would be paid for becoming an informant to help convict, not to convict, but to implicate the Quds Force people in Tehran in this scheme if he would come back to the United States. And that's what brought him back. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, they would not have been able to get him to come back. They would have to offer him both a combination of a light sentence or no sentence at all, which I think is more likely, and payment to participate in the scheme. And of course, we know when he came back, he immediately gave a full confession without benefit of any counsel. He did not have a lawyer with him for several days, voluntarily waived his right to a lawyer, gave a confession, signed a confession that they put in front of him, and then participated in phone calls to people who were alleged to be his Quds Force contact in Tehran, which was recorded by the FBI with his cooperation.
Mm-hmm. Now, one of the issues that you raise in, and I'm going to link to this article that was published by Middle East Research and Information Product Project, MERIP, which is a great outlet. Chris Tunsing and his crew there do a great job. You write about the individuals who surveyed the Khobar Towers and suggest that there are some similarities here. Tell us a little more about that.
Well, this is a very obscure, in terms of the history of U.S. relations with Iran, a very obscure episode. I'm the only one who's ever written about it. But this is based on an investigation that I did of the Khobar Towers bombing 2 years ago. It started actually 3 years ago, and I spent a full year on and off working on the subject, interviewed more than a dozen former officials, former FBI officials and others who were knowledgeable on the U.S. investigation, the FBI investigation of the Khobar Towers bombing. And what I learned from that, because I had access to the so-called 302 FBI interview, the report of the FBI interview of this Saudi Shia activist named Hani El-Sayag, a Saudi young Saudi man.
And let me just spell his name for people, S-A-Y-I-G-H, Sayag.
S-A-Y-E-G-H, or I-G-H, it's spelled both ways.
Okay. Yes.
And he was captured, he was arrested in Canada, having left Saudi Arabia 2 years earlier. He left in 1995. He was arrested in 1997 in Canada, was interrogated by an assistant attorney general, Eric DeBellier, and his 302, which I was given access to. I was able to read it, although I couldn't take notes until after I returned it, showed that he freely admitted that he had participated in this Iranian scheme to carry out surveillance against U.S. military and diplomatic targets in Saudi Arabia. He surveilled two targets, although not Khobar Towers, he said. And he said the reason for this surveillance was not to prepare the option of a terrorist attack, but rather to have for Iran to have options for retaliation in case Iran were attacked. And he said that at one point he proposed to the Iranians that there be an attack on an AWACS plane that was in on an airbase, which was in the hands of the Saudis. It had been turned over to the Saudis. And so, you know, you would think that technically it was not a violation of U.S. law. It would have nothing to do with U.S. law. But in fact, I was told by a former FBI official that this was considered to be a violation of U.S. terrorist laws because they argued, the Justice Department argued, that the Saudis carrying this out would not have known or might not have known that the plane was actually in the hands of the Saudis, which of course was untrue. But this is the kind of thing that goes on in order to make a case. And so they were going to use that as leverage to try to get him to testify before a grand jury to give him offering a light sentence in return for his testimony, in the hope that he would implicate Iran in this terrorist scheme, in the bombing of Khobar Towers. He had been accused by the Saudi government of being the driver of the getaway car, even though there was no other evidence of this that the Saudis could produce. They just made the charge. In any case, he came to the United States because he didn't want to be sent back to Saudi Arabia on the grounds that he would be beheaded. So he came to the United States and then refused to testify. He said Iran had nothing to do with this, and he was consistent in that. He said Iran would not have had any reason to do this, to carry out the bombing of Khobar Towers. There was absolutely no evidence that the Iranians had any intention of doing so. And so they finally had to send him back to Saudi Arabia.
Now, Gareth, I'd like to read a paragraph from your article here and preface it by saying that so far, it is not a crime in the United States to try to imagine how your adversaries are thinking, but it may be very soon. You wrote, with threats of an Israeli or U.S. bombing attack on Iran, with Saudi complicity, mounting since the mid-2000s, a similar campaign of surveillance of Saudi and Israeli targets in North America would fit the framework of what the Pentagon has called Iran's asymmetric warfare doctrine. If our Bob Sear spoke of such a campaign in his initial meeting with the DEA informant, he certainly would have piqued the interest of FBI counterterrorism personnel. And this scenario would also explain why the series of meetings in late June and the first half of July did not produce a single statement by our Bob Sear that the administration could quote to advance its case that the Iranian-American was interested in assassinating the ambassador or carrying out other acts of terrorism.
That's right, and we're talking here about a period of three full weeks, in which there were clearly several. We don't even know, we are not told how many meetings actually took place during those 3 weeks. It could have been 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 meetings that took place. Not a single quote, not a single specific piece of evidence that our Bob Sear said anything to indicate any interest in this idea of assassination or any other sort of terrorist action. And so, you know, it's clear that, what was going on there was something very different from what the FBI is pushing and the administration is pushing as the case in this so-called Iranian terror plot.
Gareth, what else in this report advances the story about the allegations against our Bob Sear and the really clear lack of evidence to support the administration's interpretation of this alleged plot to kill the Saudi ambassador?
Well, you're asking me what other evidence one can point to about the hypothesis that I put forward?
Well, and also just you've done more research into the allegations that were presented in the government documentation, and I just wanted to see if there's anything that's new for you that has surfaced since the initial review of the court filings against our Bob Sear.
Well, I think the only thing that's happened since that initial filing, which remains the basis for any effort to try to understand what the truth is about this, and you know the problem is how little information we really have. I mean, it's an amazing situation in which the key information that we have to have in order to understand the truth is clearly being denied us. by the administration. And so the only thing that's happened since then is that our Bob Sear has been indicted. He has pleaded not guilty. And we have no other information thus far beyond what the FBI presents in their account. The FBI agent who signed this apparently was in charge of the investigation. And it's his deposition, which is the only information that we have apart from, you know, leaks, background interviews that have been given or press briefings that have been given by administration officials. Now, they also, of course, have leaked what they claim were pieces of intelligence or information about intelligence that they claim the United States has on the so-called high-ranking Quds Force official named Shalai, who they're claiming is somehow linked with this terror plot. And the evidence that they're putting forward is that Shalai is somebody who was involved in the Iranian presence, or not presence, but not physical presence, but the Iranian policy toward Iraq back in 2007. They're saying that he was the guy who was in charge of the killing of five American servicemen in January 2007 in a Shia militia attack on a joint U.S.-Iraqi provincial center. That is complete bunk, and we know that because no one less than General David Petraeus himself gave a press briefing in April of 2007 in which he said explicitly, we have no information which links Iran to this operation, to this Shia Iraqi operation in January 2007, which killed the five Americans. And this was several weeks after they had captured the key Shia commander who was involved in the planning of it. And so if they were going to find out that there was any Iranian link, they would have found out by then.
Mm-hmm. So there's really no advance of the story in terms of substantive proof or any real confirmation of the plot alleged by our government. And I wanted to underscore that because next, I wanted to get your comments on the Sunday New York Times piece that was published on November 6th under the byline of David Sanger, their Washington chief correspondent, because I found the story fascinating on a number of levels. It does offer context and framing for the conflict between the U.S. and Iran, and by proxy for us anyway, Israel. And it leads off the article by noting that we have attempted to assassinate, we being Israel and the United States, because all these are covert ops and nobody takes open credit for them. But we, being the West, have assassinated one Iranian nuclear engineer named Shahriari. He was killed by a motorcycle that magnetically attached a bomb to his car earlier. Well, it was about a year ago. And we attempted to also kill Feridun Abbasi, a nuclear scientist and a member of the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps. He actually survived. But it's very clear that we're taking a lot of very aggressive actions to interrupt what we consider to be the Iranian plan to develop a nuclear weapon. And we need to add Stuxnet to that, because most cybersecurity stories that are published in the United States paint the U.S. as victim of cyber attacks, whether they're from anonymous hackers or from China or other parts of the world. We don't talk about our aggressive operations where we are using cyber warfare on others. That's all just scrubbed out of the conversation, and we're seen as this saintly nation that is just a victim of cyber warfare. But Stuxnet either came from the U.S. and or Israel and has really done a lot of damage to the Iranian computer systems related to its nuclear development program. And most Americans are unaware of these aggressive tactics that we're using, and therefore any idea of Iranian retaliation seems far-fetched. Well, gosh, we haven't attacked them yet. Why would they be plotting against us?
Well, this is really the larger context, which is always missing from the news media's coverage of U.S.-Iran relations and the entire range of issues, including, of course, the so-called terror plot, as well as the Iranian nuclear program. That's the context in which Iran has been in the crosshairs of the United States and Israel for the last two decades. I mean, I'm talking about specifically from 1992 to the present. There has been a strategy which was worked out between Israel and the United States, which has, of course, been revised and renewed and changed over the years, but which began with a very clear intention by the Israelis to isolate Iran on the world stage and set up a situation where eventually it could be confronted and where the regime could be weakened and they could hopefully change the regime, get rid of the Islamic Revolutionary regime in Iran. And the United States has been part of that strategy ever since, and of course it has turned into a series of military threats after 2001, particularly after 2001. Not that there were none before that, but particularly after 2001, that became the centerpiece of the Israeli strategy, and certainly the Bush administration was part of that. It certainly went along with the idea of threatening Iran. So this is not a situation where you're dealing with two countries which are sort of on an equal basis in terms of their threats to one another. It's clear that Iran has been feeling under the gun, that it is in the crosshairs. It is targeted by the United States and Israel. The Obama administration has not publicly renounced the idea of an Israeli attack. And indeed, in 2009 and 2010, there were a series of statements by David Petraeus and by Vice President Joe Biden, which also by the Secretary of Defense, Robert Gates, which said Israel feels threatened, they have a right to defend themselves, and we can't say, that it's impossible that Israel will attack Iran, that's a possibility, and they have a right to do so. The implication being the United States would not stand in the way. So this is all part of the context, which is never talked about in the coverage of Iran's nuclear program, which I think is very relevant to understanding the degree to which the Iranians want to keep secrecy surrounding, for example, their facility in Qom, which their second facility for the enrichment of uranium.
Mm-hmm.
And this, of course, was treated as a high crime by the IAEA and the international community, suggesting that this was evidence that the Iranians had the intention to build a nuclear weapon. Well, you know, it does nothing of the sort. It simply shows that they were conscious of the need to keep, for as long as possible at least, the United States and Israel guessing about where their facility would be. And also to suggest to the U.S. and Israel that targeting an attack on Iran's facilities would not be a simple matter. And I think that's really a key factor in this whole equation. So I think I probably wandered away from your question, but that's
well,
that's
Gareth,
what it,
I want to get your comments on the most recent IAEA report and American reaction to it here in a couple of minutes. But sticking with David Sanger in the New York Times, I give them partial credit. On the jump page, the article is re-headlined, The Secret War with Iran. And he does set up context regarding Stuxnet and these attempts and one successful effort to kill Iranian engineers by unknown interlopers. But here's the offending paragraph here in Sanger's article. He says, not surprisingly, the Iranians are refusing to sit back and take it, which is one reason many believe the long shadow war with Iran is about to ramp up dramatically. At the White House and CIA, officials say the recently disclosed Iranian plot to kill the Saudi ambassador to the United States by blowing up a Tony Georgetown restaurant frequented by senators, lobbyists, and journalists was just the tip of the iceberg. American intelligence officials now believe that the death of a Saudi diplomat in Pakistan earlier this year was an assassination, and they see evidence of other plots by the Quds Force, the most elite Iranian military unit, from Yemen to Latin America. Now, this is remarkable because he takes at face value the whole Arbab-Siyar case and doesn't challenge it, doesn't express a shred of skepticism about it, and then builds on that by adding his own fantasies here of a Tony Georgetown restaurant frequented by senators, lobbyists, and journalists. Again, that was the tidbit that was introduced by the DEA informant, was it not?
Absolutely, and I mean, there's nothing in the record of that account that I used as the basis for my analysis that talks about a Georgetown restaurant. I think that's a little tidbit that David Sanger has added on his own.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there was mention of a restaurant. It didn't say that it was in Georgetown at all, unless he has been tipped off by a friend in the administration that was actually said. Then he is in fact embellishing on the record. But in any case, the whole story is an embellishment. The whole story was made up by the DEA informant to entrap Arbab-Siyar and to get him to say something, saying, "Oh yeah, okay, that would be a good idea," but then, you know, it's not something that there's no evidence in the record that they agreed to it, that anybody in Tehran ever agreed to that. The only claim is that Arbab-Siyar, in his confession, says that it was approved. But that confession was written after he was part of the sting operation.
All right, now let's put a little icing on this Betty Crocker concoction here, because Sanger ups the ante by citing an unnamed spook. Quote, "The Saudi plot was clumsy and we got lucky," another American official who has reviewed the intelligence carefully said recently. "But we are seeing increasingly sophisticated Iranian activity like it all around the world." Now, there is no way of knowing if this is complete fabrication or if there is some evidence to support the unnamed source that Sanger is citing here. But this is part and parcel of the administration's rhetorical package, which is to really ramp up these depictions of Iran as a clear and present danger. And I see it as part of the domestic reelection campaign of Barack Obama, trying to mend fences with Israeli interests after being drubbed by Prime Minister Netanyahu on his visit to the U.S. earlier this year.
I don't think there's any question but that is the primary impetus for President Obama to buy into this scheme. At a higher level, in other words, I think, yes, it is domestic politics that overrides everything else. If it weren't for the fact that he feels obliged to take the hardest line possible against Iran, I think that there would be a very different policy at this point, in the sense that that he would be dialing back on the extreme rhetoric, and I think that there would probably not be the kind of emphasis on this sort of Iran terror plot notion that we're getting. But at a sort of strategic level in international politics, what this is about is that the United States had committed itself to a strategy with Israel of upping the ante on the sanctions, the economic sanctions and financial sanctions against Iran. The sanctions now are focused and justified by the Iranian nuclear program. The idea that the Iranians, the nuclear program is illicit, and that anything having to do with it, no matter how indirect, should be the subject of sanctions. Now the idea is to go beyond that and to make the sanctions bite into the Iranian economy more generally. And the Israelis are quite explicit about wanting this to be targeted against the Iranian National Bank, and to target the oil and gas sector of Iran, that those should be the main targets of the new round of sanctions. And that was the purpose of the entire IAEA report emphasis on the Danilenko alleged former Soviet nuclear weapons specialist having supposedly assisted Iran in building a device that would be a trigger mechanism for a nuclear weapon. All of this hype surrounding the IAEA report was aimed at softening up Russia and China to get them to agree to this wider range of sanctions. Of course, it's now backfired because the Russians have said, no way. I mean, this is out of line. You are now getting into territory which is much too aggressive.
Now, let's first talk about the Danilenko connection and then the Russian reaction. Because, as you point out in your report, and I'm going to link to this one as well, it was published by Interpress Service, the IAEA did not name Danilenko, who is a Ukrainian, specifically, but the description of him permitted you to figure out who he is. First, tell us how you were able to identify him, and then tell us his real credentials, which don't fit into the context that's been created here, that he is a nuclear expert.
Right. I mean, this story about Danilenko, of course, circulated around the world 3 days ago, 4 days ago, precisely because there was a background briefing given to, not to the media, but to intelligence professionals, quote-unquote, by David Albright, who is the executive director of a think tank in Washington, D.C., and the perpetual subject of interviews and citations in the news media on the Iranian nuclear program. He's more quoted than any other individual in the world about the Iranian program. And in this case, he told the assembled intelligence professionals a week or so ago that what he called the former Soviet nuclear weapons specialist, Vyacheslav Danilenko, had been hired by the Iranian government, a specific arm of the Iranian government involved in military as well as other technical research, scientific research, had hired him to come to Iran for 5 years and to help them to, as I said, to do this job of assembling and experimenting with a device that would be a multi-point implosion device that would be a trigger mechanism for a nuclear weapon. That was what he told the intelligence professionals. It was then leaked to the Washington Post. The Post story talked about Danilenko and gave the David Albright version of who he was, and that immediately was picked up by the world's news media. Now, you know, the IAEA report doesn't mention Danilenko's name, but does in fact say that he was a former Soviet nuclear weapons specialist and that he went to Iran. And they confirmed that Danilenko was, in fact, in Iran during that period because Danilenko himself said he was. However, Danilenko did explain to the IAEA that he was there to help the Iranian nanodiamond industry, the nanodiamond subsector of Iran's thriving nanotechnology sector, to build a contraption that would, in fact, synthesize nanodiamonds, which are a highly sought-after, highly prized industrial diamond product.
Right. These aren't for engagement rings.
These are not for engagement rings.
These are for tool and die operations.
Well,
where
they're for medical purposes, for a mm-hmm. lot of different purposes, and have nothing to do with nuclear weapons technology or any military application whatsoever. And so what the IAEA has done is to accept the word of a so-called member state, unnamed, which was either Israel or the United States, and I'm betting that the chances are 90% that it was Israel, that he was, in fact, a former Soviet nuclear weapons specialist, based on the fact that it was a fact that he worked at a Soviet-era research institute in Russia that did, in fact, work on nuclear weapons. It was primarily known for its work on nuclear weapons. However, not everybody who worked at that research institute worked on nuclear weapons. And, in fact, it's a matter of public record that by the time the Soviet Union came to an end, that research institute, 50% of the workforce, was working on non-military issues, non-military science and technology. And one of the things that they did from the very beginning was nanodiamonds. And Danilenko was, in fact, the person who started the work in that research institute on nanodiamonds in 1960. 1960 to 1965, or 1966, the historical record is very clear that Danilenko was working on nanodiamonds. He was a pioneer in the field. And he published, you know, professionally published technical scientific work on the subject, and he had patents, or the Soviet equivalent of patents, for inventions that were related to nanodiamonds. This is, again, a matter of published records, which show this.
Mm-hmm. Now, Gareth, the sense of this IEAE report as being reported in the commercial media here in the United States is that it underscores that Iran has a nuclear program that includes developing nuclear weapons, not just nuclear power to generate electricity. And yet the language that's being used by the new inspector, who's a Japanese scientist, pardon me, whose name I can't think of at the moment.
Yukio Amano is
Thank
the
you.
Head of the IAEA, yes.
All right. The language is strikingly similar to the tortured phrase that George W. Bush used. I believe it was in the 2004 State of the Union message, where he said that Iraq has a weapons of mass destruction program development related activities or something like that. And it was so long and strung out that by the time you got to the end of it, it meant absolutely nothing.
Well, I think what you're referring to is the phrase possible possible military developments.
Mm-hmm.
And this is the phrase that the IAEA has been using ever since 2008 for those things that they're charging amount to evidence of Iranian work on nuclear weapons. But as a former IAEA inspector, Robert Kelly, who was quoted in the Christian Science Monitor in an excellent story by Scott Peterson this week, has pointed out the evidence, the so-called evidence that's offered in this report, just like all the previous ones, which I've also been studying very carefully over the years, is very thin. And he said the amount of new information here that goes beyond the so-called laptop documents, the laptop of death documents, which were turned over to the United States in 2004, is shockingly small. He said there's very little new that's involved in this report. And he said what the IAEA did in its analysis, he called it unprofessional. He said that it's just the kind of inferences, the kind of reasoning that they use to reach conclusions in that report are simply unprofessional. And that's exactly what I have found in my study of the IAEA reports over the years.
I'd also just like to add that our mutual colleague, Robert Perry, at consortiumnews.com has written a very strong piece in reaction to the IAEA report and coverage of it. And he also builds on your reportage, Gareth, to basically debunk this escalating notion and the way it is being hyped. And we have to go back to the last reliable national intelligence estimate, which was published over the objections of Dick Cheney, because it established that Iran stopped its effort to develop a nuclear weapon in approximately 2003. And to date, I have not seen anything that actually contradicts that.
You're right. I mean, what we know about the newest iteration of the national intelligence estimate on Iran's nuclear program certainly suggests that there is no smoking gun, there is no compelling evidence that Iran has actually resumed, and if it did in fact have active work on a nuclear weapon, that it has not resumed anything of any significance since 2003. And I think what that, the newest iteration of the intelligence community's conclusions about the Iranian program, what it tells us is that that the IAEA's work, which incorporates to a great extent information which is given to them by Israel, is not being accepted by the U.S. intelligence community. They recognize that Israel is an interested party here, which has a strong reason, and in fact, you know, they know very well that the Israelis have been pushing on them information, intelligence, so-called intelligence, which they did not accept. They did not think that it was genuine. They did not buy it. And specifically, intelligence on this very question of an Iranian experiment or set of experiments on a trigger mechanism. This is what the Israelis have been pushing for years now, and the U.S. intelligence community has simply not bought it.
Mm-hmm. And Gareth, you know, this is, again, one of those angles that political correctness is resistant to in the United States these days. But if we take just one moment and analyze this from the Iranian perspective, simple recent history. Muammar Gaddafi gave up what he pretended was a nuclear weapons program. I don't think it was very substantial, but he had one at least on paper. He gave it up, and we saw what happened to him. And if you are Ahmadinejad or the Grand Ayatollah, and you look at the world picture, and you say, well, you know, bluffing about having a nuke has a lot of advantages. Being exposed as a non-nuclear power in this region when our archenemy Israel is the only identified nuclear power, that doesn't have many advantages. And so what interest should we expect Iran to have in exposing its own lack of a nuclear weapon, its non-development, when they would probably think that makes them even more vulnerable?
I think you're absolutely right, Peter, and I would just add to what you've said, that what you're describing here is a logic, a sort of logical interest on the part of a country that has the capacity, scientific and technical capacity, to make claims of potential for being a nuclear power. And it's been done over the years by a number of countries, including Argentina, Brazil, Egypt. And, of course, the primary instance of this is Japan, a country which does not have a nuclear weapon, but is known to be capable of producing a nuclear weapon within a matter of weeks or at most a few months. And the Iranians have made no secret that they regard the Japanese model as the one that they are guided by. And that model is one that says, you know, we are not going to go for a nuclear weapon. We're not going to have a nuclear weapon. But we want you to know that if you attack us, if you push us too far, we have the capability for making that decision at some point in the future. And that then constitutes a deterrent, of a sort of an elementary deterrent on the part of Iran to an attack by the United States and or Israel. And then, one more point that I would add to that. In addition to the deterrent element in keeping the United States and the rest of the world guessing about exactly where they are in the process, how much capability they have to be able to produce a weapon, there is also the very important factor that unless the United States believes that the Iranians have the capability at some point in the future to produce a weapon, they are not going to take Iran seriously. The United States has no interest in talking to Iran or negotiating with Iran. And so the Iranians have come to the conclusion over the years, after having failed in the previous decade, in the 1990s, to get the United States to negotiate with them seriously, They have concluded that without the belief that Iran has the potential for being a nuclear power, the United States will never sit down and seriously negotiate with them and eliminate the structural hostility the United States has maintained against Iran since the early to mid-1990s, to eliminate the sanctions and all the other legal and political impediments to normal relations.
And Gareth, the last bit of irrationality in this picture, at least for me, is the idea that we must stop Iran from even the development of a nuclear weapon. Now,
to have the capability to have the technical capability,
right? That we need to preemptively deny them the capability,
right?
Because if they developed one, it would change everything. And I just think that is so extreme. And I'm sorry, I believe it reflects the most extreme of Israeli paranoia, that if Iran developed a weapon or even the very clear capability, that they would use it and that this would disrupt the balance of terror in the Middle East. And I don't think that can be predicted, but I also don't believe that the worst case should be assumed. And we are being driven to the brink of war right now by people who, in every case, take the worst and most extreme possibility and embrace it as a fact.
Right. And I think there are two things that really contribute to this very unfortunate and very dangerous tendency in U.S. policy, which has been, you know, certainly evident for many years now. One is the one that you've referred to, that is that the United States has followed the lead of Israel in the case of sort of understanding and responding, particularly responding to the Iranian nuclear program for many years. And I think that it's only really just in the last few years that the U.S. intelligence community has, in fact, gotten a bit of spine and has stood up for a degree of truth in this matter. If you go back further, to the 1990s and the early period of this century, I think you see the intelligence community bending much more toward the political imperatives of this sort of suspicion of the worst case scenario that the Israelis continue to press on the United States. So there's no doubt that the politics of U.S.-Israeli relations has been a very important, I would say probably the more important of the two factors that are relevant here. But the second factor that I want to mention is the suspicion that comes within the U.S. national security state itself. And it goes back to the 1980s. It goes back to the period when the CIA was involved in a dirty war with the Iranians and their proxies, their allies in Lebanon, in 1983, 1984, when the Iranians clearly were involved in plots that had to do with blowing up the Marines, the Marine base in Lebanon, and the U.S. Embassy in Beirut, and also kidnapping and torturing and killing the U.S. station chief in Beirut. This left a legacy of great bitterness within the CIA, and I can tell you that this has, I think, a degree of influence over the way in which the CIA has dealt with Iran for many, many years. I think we're still seeing the influence of that bitterness on the part of CIA veterans of the 1980s. You see that the people in the counterterrorism center, which was set up in the early 1990s, the late 1980s, early 1990s, these are people who were involved in Lebanon in many cases. They remember how their colleagues were killed by the Iranians. They've never forgiven them. And so there is a degree of grudge that is bearing on this U.S. treatment of Iran in general and of the Iranian nuclear program in particular.
Gareth Porter, shifting to one more topic before we wrap up here, you have been providing great coverage of the situation in Afghanistan, the expanded use of night raids by the U.S. military in efforts to suppress insurgent activity where we have occupied certain regions. And I also credit Anand Gopal, who originally exposed night raids and secret prisons remain active in Afghanistan, even under President Obama. And I am grateful to Clive Stafford Smith, the British attorney, who he's actually an American, but he operates out of Britain. And he wrote an op-ed that was in the same New York Times we were trashing just a few minutes ago and put a face on the U.S. presence and the way that our night raids and drone strikes take lives of innocent people. And he introduces us to a 16-year-old boy named Tariq Aziz, apparently not named for the former Iraqi foreign minister.
Presumably not.
But they do carry the same name. And they were at a yurga, one of these kind of tribal-based conferences or meetings in Afghanistan. And within 3 days, a drone had struck and killed this 16-year-old boy. And I think it's important for people to really understand the human aspect of this, because we see it as statistics, we see it as a far-off war, and the numbers we pay attention to are American casualties, not the deaths of innocent civilians caught in the crossfire.
Yes, and you know, you've sort of drawn you've sort of connected two dots here. They're not just dots, they're huge blotches, in fact, on the stains on the American conscience, the drone strikes in Pakistan and the night raids in Afghanistan. And they are, in fact, very related in regard to the underlying logic that drives both of these sort of U.S. programs that involve the killing of thousands of people. One is that targeting is based on intelligence, which is extremely let me put it this way. It depends on very little to decide that someone is a target. There's one case that we know about from Pakistan, the drone strikes in Pakistan, where a person's house was visited by some Taliban soldiers, and they asked for food and then went away. And the next day, the house was blown up, and the owner of the house's son was killed. And I mean, this is just an example of the kind of logic that goes into the targeting. And the second thing is that there's no accountability. I mean, the people who do the targeting, the people responsible for the killing, are not accountable to anyone for the decisions that they make. They're not being reviewed. There's no way that the public has, or Congress has, even if Congress was willing to do it, to really hold these people accountable for any standards of truth, much less morality. And therefore, they feel very free to exercise the power of life and death over people, which is being carried out in ways that are completely irresponsible. And the night raids is really the same thing. The same thing's going on. The intelligence is done in such a way as to target people who they know in many cases are not insurgents, they're civilians, but they put them on their kill and capture list so that they can carry them away and interrogate them. And then they break down the door of their house in the middle of the night, and if they resist, if they do what any Pashtun male is trained to do, to reach for his gun, and if you appear with your gun, you're going to be killed. And my story that you've alluded to, the story about More than 1,500 people, civilians, being killed in night raids in a 10-month period, based on the statistics that were put out by the U.S. NATO command itself. The only difference is that they claimed that these people were all Taliban insurgents, whereas I was able to use some very elementary math and the knowledge that these raids are essentially night raids, and that means they're targeting individuals and not groups. And you find out that an average of 2.5 people are being killed every time shots are fired in the night raids, then you can figure out that this number of people, more than 1,500 people, were not targeted in the night raids, and that means that they were killed because they were Pashtun males who reached for their guns in almost every case.
Well, and let me cite from your article here to put this in further perspective. Night raids are the leading cause of civilian deaths in Afghanistan.
That's right, and this is a very well-kept secret from the American people and from the world's public by the fact that the United Nations mission in Afghanistan has put forward an extremely misleading report on civilian casualties, which claims that it's IEDs laid by the Taliban, which are the leading cause of death. They cite in the most recent report, I believe, 904.
That's right.
IEDs, which are not, 904 civilian deaths caused by IEDs, whereas this is, a little bit less than two-thirds of the number of deaths. The minimum, absolute minimum, I think it's much larger than this, but absolute minimum number of deaths, just over 10 months, caused by U.S. night raids.
And the figures show that in that 10-month period, there were 6,200 night raids, which is 628 per month.
That's right.
I don't think most Americans have any idea of these tactics being used and how inaccurate they can be in actually locating and capturing the actual insurgents. Because, as we know, they don't wear uniforms, they don't report to a barracks, and they do attempt to blend in with local population. And so when you look at that, the prospect of incidentally, accidentally, or intentionally killing civilians as part of the effort to rout and kill insurgents, this is a very high cost of
well,
the
it's
occupation.
One of the great myths that has been propounded successfully by Generals McChrystal and Petraeus, that they and their friends at the Joint Command, the Special Operations Joint Command, have created this system that is so finely attuned to who is a Taliban insurgent and who isn't, that they can reduce civilian casualties to a handful. The reality is that they really don't know who the Taliban are and that they have to engage in, as I say, the kind of targeting that frequently involves just picking up large numbers of adult male Pashtuns and taking them off for interrogation in the hope that they can get some information on who the Taliban are. And so that means that they put them on their kill and capture target list, and that means that either those people on the target list themselves or their family, friends, and neighbors are likely to be killed in a raid because of this problem of Pashtunwali, which is that adult male Pashtuns have an absolute moral obligation to come to the aid of people in their family or in their neighborhood who are under attack.
Mm-hmm. Well, Gareth, I want to thank you for the excellent work you're doing on Iran, on Afghanistan, and for providing important history and context to these stories that are often thrust on us with none, no history, no context, and we're expected to believe things that are not proven, and then we see events moving very rapidly based on unproven allegations, and this is a very frightening prospect. And I hate to see these patterns repeated that we deplored so much during the Bush administration, and I equally deplore them under President Obama.
Well, I appreciate your interest in my work. Thanks so much, Peter.
All right, Gareth. We'll talk again soon, I'm sure.
Thanks.
As promised, here comes Gary Chu with a film review of the new flick starring Leonardo DiCaprio and produced by Clint Eastwood about J. Edgar Hoover.
Unlike John Waters, director Clint Eastwood doesn't have a sense of humor that would allow him to title his latest film, Johnny and Clyde. Appropriately, it's J. Edgar. Mr. Hoover's first name was John, but many close to him, except his mother, called him Johnny. The iconic and controversial director of the Federal Bureau of Investigation had as his deputy a close associate who Hoover hired early on at the FBI. His name was Clyde Tolson. Now, with that tacky joke behind us, here's more on an interesting biopic that may raise a few eyebrows. A history-laden account of J. Edgar Hoover, from the approximate time he was first hired by the Department of Justice until his death in 1972. Hoover served as director of the FBI for life, being appointed in 1935 during the Roosevelt administration as its first director. His tenure commenced with the Coolidge administration's 1924 appointment of him as the sixth director of the Bureau of Investigation, forerunner to the FBI. As Hoover, Leonardo DiCaprio seems omnipresent. I can hardly think of a scene that DiCaprio isn't in, acting his heart out, always giving it at least 120%. Dame Judi Dench plays J. Edgar's mother, Annie Hoover. Naomi Watts is Hoover's girl Friday, Helen Gandy, and Army Hammer, the great-grandson of the late business magnate Armand Hammer, does the role of Clyde Tolson. It's almost as if all the people in the cinema are voyeurs watching a biopic. It seemed more pointed seeing one about Hoover, whose private life was even more a hot topic than his public exploits fighting communists, labor unions, bank robbers, kidnappers, people of color, PRing the hell out of the FBI, and keeping in tow more powerful people than he by maintaining his celebrated file of dirt on them. The list of rumors runs almost as long as the ones he ferreted out about his many adversaries, real and imagined. Was Hoover homosexual? Was he a cross-dresser? Did he have a long-running intimate relationship with Tolson? Was J. Edgar a racist? And on the other hand, did he have a secret lineage back to a black Mississippi family? His public life connected with such personalities as Emma Goldman, Bruno Hauptmann, Robert F. Kennedy, Martin Luther King Jr., Charles Lindbergh, Dorothy L'Amour, Ginger Rogers, Melvin Purvis, John Dillinger, Roy Cohn, Joseph McCarthy, and assorted 20th century American heroes and bad guys. And did I mention eight of our presidents? Whether or not you liked Hoover, that's one awesome resume. Clint Eastwood, despite his macho persona and Dirty Harry history, is not homophobic, so I wasn't surprised to find that J. Edgar is quite tender in the scenes that depict the relationship between Hoover and Tolson. They're moving and will likely generate sympathy for Hoover in his moments of anguish with his partner. Eastwood screenwriter Dustin Lane Black likely exerted as well some control of the private relationship of Hoover and Tolson. Black won an Oscar for his original script for the award-winning film Milk. Born in 1974 in Sacramento, Black was raised Mormon and has also had success as a scriptwriter for the well-received HBO series Big Love. Black is also an LGBT activist. Briefly, J. Edgar caused me to suppress laughter that took its energy from my terribly off-center sense of humor. When DiCaprio, in character as Hoover, is in deep grief about the passing of his mother, Clint kicks in the cross-dressing scene with soft Eastwoodian music. When Hoover puts his mother's beads on and slips into one of her dresses standing in front of a large mirror, the first thing that came to my mind was Tony Perkins' Norman Bates dispatching Janet Leigh and Martin Balsam. We remember who Norman thought he was as he slipped into slasher mode in that unforgettable Hitchcock thriller. But the J. Edgar scene is played somber, and decency demands acknowledging Hoover's suffering for loss of his mother and her death as well. That, despite Mrs. Hoover being apparently much the cause of her son's paranoia, guilt, and obsession to organize and control. Eastwood walks softly but carries a big megaphone while seated in the director's chair, except when the eighth U.S. president shows up for the close of the J. Edgar years. That would be Christopher Shire playing Richard M. Nixon. The Nixonian voice is spot on. If you bring a youngster along for J. Edgar, you might want to put cotton in his or her ears when Mr. Nixon comes on screen to carry forward much of what Mr. Hoover had already been doing politically behind so many backs well before the man from Whittier withdrew himself from being kicked around. 1973 was the year that followed J. Edgar Hoover's demise. The guy with this voice urges you to read all his online film reviews at TulsaTVMemories.com or at IMDb.com. I'm Gary Chu, up, over, and down in the valley.
Thanks for joining me for another podcast. Will you share it with your friends? I sure hope so. Then send an email to Peter at PeterBCollins.com.
Happy trails to you until again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling.